our keynote speaker for this morning's session, John Gorman. John is the founder of the CEO of Nightingale Partners. Nightingale's mission is to improve the quality of care and reduce unnecessary healthcare expenditures for the most vulnerable patients through advanced technology, locally curated social service programs, and the innovative financing to address social determinants of health. We all know John, and it's been a long time friend of ICE, and we're looking forward to his presentation this morning. John?
Thanks so much, Mike. Good morning, everybody. It's great to be back here at ICE. I guess now we got to call it HICE, huh, Mike? We could do Medicare, Medicaid, ICE, and just kind of follow in the CMS pattern there. But good move on the rebranding, brother. That's great. I'm thrilled to be back here with everyone at ICE. So sorry we couldn't all be together. Certainly these are, bizarre times. And hopefully this time next year, we'll all be back in San Francisco together. And I'll certainly be looking forward to that. Here we are, day 29 of Squattergate for the lame duck Alarange. We're counting down 49 days to the inauguration here in DC. For me, this has been like Christmas or Hanukkah come early this last month. I mean, we're getting to watch Trump lose this election all over again on an almost daily basis. Yesterday, as everybody's aware, Arizona and Wisconsin certified their election results. Trump's now lost all six challenges to overturn the election results. He's 0-38 in court. He's basically undefeated and losing so far since the election was called, but has still managed to raise $170 million off of this trope about the election being stolen. And I almost feel bad for the folks who are continuing to contribute to this, because basically you're just funding his legal defense fund at this point. The attorney general came out yesterday and said there was no evidence of election fraud. We started a pool in our office here at Nightingale about which day this week he's going to get fired. I mean, this is one of Trump's most obnoxiously loyal allies, with emphasis on lies. And now he's allegedly going to be cast as one of the great members of this conspiracy against the president that appointed him. And even Rudy Giuliani's begging for a pardon as of yesterday. And I think the case the guy must have made was that without Rudy, Trump would be the most embarrassing member of the team over there. I mean, he's even over there screaming, I'm sure, that his hair bled for Trump last week. So, I mean, anytime you got a guy asking for a preemptive pardon, tells you he's been up to no good, too. But all humor aside, and, the results so far of this crazy post-election month, I think it's really important for all of us in the healthcare industry to never lose sight of the fact that 12 million Americans are going to lose unemployment benefits the day after Christmas, that 47 million Americans are unemployed right now. When you look at the one-time COVID relief package that the Republican Senate passed back in first quarter, that relief now amounts to $4 a day for folks who are struggling through this pandemic. The eviction moratorium is going to expire on January 1, and that's going to result in as many as 8 to 12 million Americans being evicted in first quarter. And all of these things are going to just hugely contribute to the healthcare costs of our enrolled populations, especially in government programs where the populations are the most vulnerable. So against that backdrop, today we'll talk about what to expect from President-elect Biden's incoming administration, particularly as it pertains to Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, and social determinants of health. We'll talk about the outlook for supplemental benefits and social determinants of health interventions in 2021 in our favorite programs. We'll look at the latest on the industry's arms race and what to expect in terms of investment in social services that better support our members, and why these interventions are so central to the long-term success of Medicare Advantage, Medicaid, and Obamacare plans. And a couple of takeaways for you guys this morning. Biden certainly promises in all of his transition documents to usher in a golden age of health equity across this country, both in terms of new investments and new priorities that we'll see in this administration, certainly as opposed to the one currently in office with 49 days counting. Social determinants of health, or SDOH, these are basically, as I've always said to you guys, just four fancy words for poverty. And social determinants account for 60 to 80% of healthcare spending in this country. Certainly that 80% at the high end of that range for our seniors, because what I also love to tell you guys is that in healthcare, poverty charges interest. And so when you've lived a lifetime of poverty, you've lived in communities with poor environmental health, poor educational attainment, poor economic opportunity, that over a lifetime that bears costs in terms of comorbidities and the severity of illness and vulnerability to social factors. So it really behooves all of us to look at our social determinants in new ways among our membership, and to invest heavily, especially from the dividend that we all gained in first and second quarter during the lockdown, when folks were home and really weren't utilizing healthcare services a whole lot. Our industry, you know, reaped billions of dollars in benefits from lower utilization, that we are really strong advocates of folks learning to use that dividend to invest in anti-poverty and benefits and interventions that will help us reduce costs in 2021 as the pandemic rages completely out of control and before a vaccine arrives. So this is going to be the winter of our discontent in our industry in terms of explosions in utilization across the board. And addressing poverty is going to be the best way to bend the curve in 2022 and beyond. We can expect some dramatically different priorities from this administration as opposed to Trump's. Certainly in healthcare priorities that Biden has made very clear and were really the linchpins of his whole campaign. I think certainly number one is going to be pandemic response and economic relief, which is obviously going to require a majority in the Senate to get there. So now all eyes are on the January 5th runoffs in Georgia, where two Senate seats are up and well within reach, because it's a runoff by definition, of the two Democratic candidates that are challenging the two most corrupt Republican members of the Senate in David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler in that election. So all eyes and election spending are now turned to Georgia. I just love how the Republicans have basically been saying that because Loeffler and Perdue didn't give enough to get Trump reelected in Georgia, which famously went for Biden and first time in a generation, and therefore that Republicans shouldn't do anything to help Loeffler and Perdue get reelected. I love that logic, and I hope we'll see more of it in the run-up to the January 5th runoffs. Joe has made the linchpin of his campaign the protection and the extension of the Affordable Care Act. Very notably, guys, we had the Supreme Court hear oral arguments on November 10th, scarcely a week after the election, on whether or not the entire Affordable Care Act should be invalidated because of the case brought by 20 Republican attorneys general, led by the, you know, the bonehead in Texas, and now supported by the Trump administration. I mean, his own Solicitor General has been supporting this this bullshit case in the Supreme Court. Luckily, we found some surprise arguments from some of the most conservative members of SCOTUS, especially those appointed by Trump, almost ironically, who argued that just because the individual mandate has been declared unconstitutional, that there is what we call severability, and that that means that the rest of the law should stand. So we're not going to see written opinions on this until probably second quarter of 2020, but certainly the oral arguments would lead most court watchers to believe that the Affordable Care Act will survive this challenge in the Supreme Court. But still, there's a lot that Joe wants to do in terms of expanding the ACA, which we'll talk about in just a second. We're going to see a dramatic reorientation around Medicaid policy away from those of Seema Verma, Trump's CMS administrator, and just to my thinking, the worst CMS administrator in the agency's history, and who famously made absolutely bullshit and completely discredited work requirements in Medicaid the hill that she will die on. So I think we're going to see a rapid reorientation away from work requirements and generally from Republican Medicaid policy in particular. You're going to see a big effort by Biden to try to reduce drug prices, especially around those that have risen exponentially during the pandemic, most notably insulin. The costs of insulin have gone up 4 to 6 times, depending on the market you're in, since Trump took office. And obviously, that's one that we really need to get our hands around its neck to really make it work for the most vulnerable patients in the system who need it the most. Certainly, one of the things that Joe has made a priority for his administration is eliminating health disparities in government programs. I think this is really timely, considering that we've seen health disparities in Medicare Advantage in particular have been on the rise for the last 4 years. No wonder under this administration, but I think we all need to be aware that this is going to be a major priority of the Biden administration. This can be done through administrative fiat. This doesn't necessarily require legislation for Biden to do this. So the incoming CMS administrator and the incoming Health and Human Services Secretary, who have not been appointed yet, are going to be critically important in the mission of this administration going forward. Certainly by addressing healthcare disparities, we can really move the needle on health equity and really starting to address, you know, the needs of the most vulnerable patients in Medicare Advantage, in Medicaid, and certainly in the Obamacare plans as well. So we should expect a big push on that across the board very soon after this administration takes office. Joe and Kamala Harris have made addressing surprise medical bills, especially pandemic-related healthcare costs, and making the vaccine and COVID-related treatment free. That means no out-of-pocket costs for everybody in government-sponsored programs. Now, his moonshot goals are going to be, of course, expanding Medicare availability so that folks can enroll in the program at age 60, one of the most rapidly growing populations of the uninsured are folks in their middle 50s to into their 60s. And that has really been exacerbated by the huge spike in unemployment that's occurred as a result of the pandemic. So I call these moonshots because these obviously will require major legislative efforts to enact, as would standing up a public option. We know there's going to be brutal Republican resistance in the Senate to this, and really underscoring the all-consuming importance of the January 5th runoffs in Georgia, which would, of course, if the Democrats win, would reclaim control of the Senate in 2021. So hugely related to what happens in Georgia on January 5th. As far as pandemic response, there's a bipartisan Senate working group operating right now. What's, you know, really considered a pretty meager response in terms of what the House has called for. Interestingly, what Joe has laid out for our audience here today would be a massive increase in the federal match for Medicaid, certainly during the pandemic crisis. And until that gets resolved by widespread inoculations with the vaccine starting in first quarter of next year, you know, that's going to be very important to state Medicaid programs, and especially to those that were smart enough to expand Medicaid as a result of the Affordable Care Act. So you're going to see a big increase there. Again, this would require legislation and will be a top priority for this administration as that bill comes up as their number one priority in January, once Biden takes office on January 21. You're going to see major new investments in public health and in refunding the CDC and all of the various public health agencies across HHS. So we expect that HRSA will see major increases in new funding, especially the Community Health Center program. We will see guaranteed coverage with no out-of-pocket costs for testing, vaccines, and treatment. So all plans in Medicare Advantage, Medicaid, and Obamacare should expect that all of those costs will be covered under their monthly payments from those federal programs. You will see a big push to expand the ACA's subsidies down to well below 400% of the federal poverty limit. And Biden has really made a priority offering temporary platinum level federal plans on the exchange. So I should expect that we'll see that in the new open enrollment that we'll see in the fall of 22. But that I fully expect that, you know, one thing that you'll see in ACA reforms will be the opening of a special election period, probably in second, third quarter during the pandemic, so that more folks can get access to Affordable Care Act coverage with these new subsidies as soon as a relief bill is passed. And I think you're going to see a major push to invoking the Defense Production Act around the PPE stockpile and the pipeline. And, you know, you guys will remember famously back in second quarter, Trump absolutely turned this into the Hunger Games for states around their own PPE supplies. And I think you're going to see a return to a federal strategy to leverage the federal government's purchasing power under the DPA to make that available. Again, under expansion and ACA stabilization, you'll see some real moonshot initiatives here that we've been talking about. But notably, what he'll be able to do administratively is a complete turnaround on Section 1332 waivers out of the Innovation Center at CMS. Now, guys, remember, if the Supreme Court, and it seems like a long shot, does end up invalidating the ACA in their written opinions, in their final ruling coming in second quarter, let's not forget that the entire Innovation Center at CMS was funded by a $10 billion initiative out of the Affordable Care Act. So if the, you know, the nuclear scenario, and it's very, very unlikely, again, given the oral arguments that we heard on November 10th, that would absolutely lay a mushroom cloud over the entire Innovation Center, among other things, at CMS. But assuming that will not happen, you're going to see a major administrative push for the Biden administration and whoever Joe should appoint to run CMS to completely rethink these 1332 waivers away from what Verma's been doing and using it to actually reduce coverage under state Medicaid programs, like Georgia famously is looking at it, Oklahoma as well. Those waivers will get turned on their head, and they'll now be used to try to achieve universal coverage through expansion of ACA options and Medicaid for those states that will be willing to do it under the Section 1332 authority in the ACA. So a total turnabout at CMS. And that's also where you're going to see the tip of the spear on Joe's priority to really get us to health equity by first declaring war on health disparities across all federal programs and across all federal agencies. So you're going to see a big push to reinvest in data-driven strategies to screen for social determinants. And you're going to see a big push in quality measures, certainly in Medicare Advantage and across Medicaid and the exchange plans, around reducing and eliminating racial and social health disparities across these programs. You're going to see a major push around innovation center demonstrations on innovation against social determinants and anti-poverty initiatives. You're going to see a complete turnaround from Trump's priorities to get rid of cultural competence and racial sensitivity training across federal agencies, and to make sure that we are being at the top of our license and being culturally competent across the healthcare workforce. You're going to see a complete rollback of Trump's discriminatory policies toward the LGBTQ plus communities. And you're going to see, as I said, major new investments in health equity research and data collection. So, you know, a bright new light around health equity and new priorities across all federal programs and agencies to begin addressing it. And that really speaks to recognition in this this administration, guys, around the critical role of social determinants of health, poverty, and population health going forward. As we've been saying, and which should be common knowledge by now, you know, these are attributable to 60 to 80%, certainly among dual eligibles and low-income seniors, of the, you know, the absolutely pernicious effects of social determinants in healthcare spending. And if we want to get anywhere, guys, in bending the curve and having the hope of any success in population health and the billions of dollars we're all investing in it, we have to deal with the underlying effects of poverty if we want to be successful. Now, across all of our federal programs, especially again in Medicaid, Medicare Advantage, particularly for duals, and in the Obamacare exchanges, we've got to get really aggressive this year, especially with this pandemic raging out of control. And it's absolutely outsize effect on these populations. I mean, it should not be lost on any of us that since this pandemic began, that African Americans are dying at four times the rate of COVID than their white counterparts, that Latinos are dying at three times the rate, and in many markets, four times the rate of white beneficiaries in these programs, that Native American populations are dying at six times the rate from COVID. And all of those health disparities that Joe has made a priority to address in his administration have been exacerbated during this pandemic. Black mortality rates in pregnancy, childbirth, and following childbirth are four to six times the rate of white women now across all federal programs. So this pandemic has lit a fire on already huge effects of poverty that we're seeing across these programs. And now is the time, as we've said, to really get smart about what's happening in our enrolled populations, to leverage the authorities that have been given us in Medicaid, Obamacare, and especially in Medicare Advantage to offer new and innovative social benefits and to use some of that dividend that we accrued in first and second quarter when utilization was way down and begin to leverage that investment and external capital into some of these benefits that you see here. You know, one of the things that's troubled me is that CMS authorized the deployment of these types of benefits across these programs, but didn't offer any new money for us to cover them. So it's imperative for us to look for existing sources of revenue, and we got plenty of it, as we said earlier this year, as a result of that reduced utilization, but now external sources of capital to begin to offer some of these benefits that we see here that the research shows conclusively. And this is where we really got to get the actuaries in our companies to recognize that these are not experimental benefits any longer, that the research is absolutely conclusive, that offering community health worker coordination to members with comorbidities and with, you know, really dramatic social needs, community health workers has been dramatically shown to reduce healthcare costs by $2,200 to $2,500 per member per year, every year for the patients that they are paneled to. That addressing loneliness and social isolation, especially among seniors who've been locked down in this pandemic, you know, loneliness is the equivalent of smoking 15 to 20 cigarettes a day for our seniors right now. And it's a dramatic reduction in their healthcare costs to make them feel less isolated, to offer them adult daycare services and community events where they can be among, and even online and telehealth events where they can be among their peers, be among others. It's critical to recognize that the vast majority of seniors right now, over 60%, are having fewer than one adult interaction on a monthly basis right now. And it has profound health effects on their mental health, their behavioral health, and as a result on all of their comorbidities. We have epidemic levels of food insecurity in this country right now that we have not seen since the Depression and since the Spanish flu back in 1918, guys. Our members are starving and their family members are starving out there. And the absolute most impactful benefit that we can offer these vulnerable members of ours is a food security benefit right now. Food security has been shown to reduce healthcare expenditures by net at least $2,500 to $3,000 per patient per year, especially for our uncontrolled diabetics whose diabetes and H1Cs are just raging out of control as more and more of those of us around us who are unemployed can no longer spend the exorbitant money that it costs for their insulin. I mean, even a $10 out-of-pocket co-payment for insulin is out of reach for millions of our members right now. So to really help the folks that are in greatest need, we need to be thinking about waiving co-pays on insulin and providing food, simple food security benefits for the most vulnerable of our patients. And then the results that we will see in net reduced healthcare expenditures follow almost immediately with food security benefits, housing and home safety and home modifications, loneliness outreach, and the deployment of community health workers alongside transportation benefits to get these folks to the appointments that they now so desperately need while this is going on. Some guiding principles that should direct our efforts around this. And guys, you know, there's nothing that says these benefits have to be offered during the benefit cycle that we see in Medicare Advantage or in Obamacare or in Medicaid. All of these things can be offered off benefit and can be provided to those who need them the most. Those benefits should be clear and easy to understand. that they should be equitable and targeted, obviously, to those with greatest need, to stretch your dollars the furthest, and to make sure that they are most impactful in terms of reduced healthcare expenditures. And guys, never forget, in star ratings, who are the biggest drags on stars? We all know it's the duals. Those are the folks who are in the greatest need right now, and they're the folks that will have the greatest net impact in your CAHPS and HAWS survey results by providing them the services that they need the most right now. These services need to be designed to be manageable and, most importantly, sustainable. Once we offer these benefits, we can't go back. I mean, once you offer a meal benefit or a transportation benefit to folks, you really can't take that away from them year after year. So it's critical that the financing for these types of benefits be sustainable. And if you don't have that cash on hand and you can't find ways of leveraging those savings that result from offering them in years 1 and 2 into financing them sustainably in years 3 and beyond, then looking to sustainable sources of external capital, which we'll talk about in a second, as part of that benefit design so that you can continue to offer them once you do. And these benefits need to evolve with experience, and they need to be data driven around their effectiveness and who should be continually brought into these new benefit cohorts for intervention. Now, what we see the market leaders, especially in Medicare Advantage, doing is still a pretty modest experimental approach that you see to these types of anti-poverty and social determinant benefits. Now, over-the-counter drugs have become basically table stakes alongside vision, hearing, and dental benefits over this last couple of years. We have seen far fewer numbers of Blues plans and provider-sponsored plans offering these types of benefits, but they have been slightly ahead of the game in providing meal benefits and transportation benefits to Medicare Advantage beneficiaries in 2020. Now, this screams to me that this is basically little more than a marketing effort to entice new beneficiaries into your plans and to try to keep members that you've got. But I don't see a whole lot of tie-in here with real benefit design and with care management programs that are going on. In some cases, of course, that's the case. But these are very modest benefits to be offering, especially in the middle of a pandemic in 2020. In terms of what we're seeing this year, you see a lot of these types of benefits really, guys, tend to be most broadly offered to what I like to call in our programs the worried well. You know, you're seeing like fitness benefits, obviously, are, you know, hugely popular. But they're really, the uptake on those types of benefits is not great among duals and others that are in greatest need. You know, you see preventive dental is getting a lot more common, and that's really critical considering that there isn't a Medicare dental benefit to speak of. But, you know, generally what you see here and in the most discussed types of benefits generally are targeted to the worried well, or really seem to be much more oriented to marketing or member retention initiatives rather than plugging them into care management programs. And some of the, you know, these benefits that are most meaningful for really underserved beneficiaries, like in-home support services or even transportation and meal benefits, really still pretty modest in where the plans are this year. You see, again, offering of things like acupuncture or therapeutic massage. You know, again, these are worried well types of benefits to, you know, they're really designed for more favorable selection, frankly, enrollment initiatives. But I tell you, the most innovative benefit that I saw in 2020 that not nearly enough plans are considering, guys, is pest control and home modifications. Just a simple pest control allowance, like plans like Anthem are doing this year, where you get a $500 annual allowance for pest control and for home modifications. You know, getting a beneficiary with asthma or COPD to get them out of a moldy basement, or to you know, eradicate cockroaches in their apartment where that's exacerbating their asthma or their COPD. Those things are hugely impactful in terms of healthcare costs and are really the types of benefits that the folks that we care the most about really need in this kind of environment. So when we look at the new primarily health-related supplemental benefits and what we know about what the plans are going to be doing in 2021, you know, we see a little bit of modest uptake across the plans there, but not really enough in terms of the SSBCI benefits that are, you know, really some of the most impactful. We see very little, precious little uptake here around these types of benefits. And frankly, we won't even know what they look like in 2021 until CMS reveals them in Q1 of next year. So we won't really know a lot about what especially the market leaders will be doing in this area, but you know, you are seeing some modest uptick here in stuff that's really meaningful, like home-based palliative care. I am absolutely bewildered why we saw a decline in the number of plans offering support for caregivers of their enrollees. You see that decline from 125 plans this year to only 95 plans next year. I mean, that just does not make any sense to me when caregivers need more support than ever, when everybody's stuck at home and we're seeing all of the comorbidities these vulnerable family members they're caring for are being exacerbated. So that's really one that we really want to look very carefully at in our benefit designs going forward. I think what we're going to see in terms of the future of benefit design here, as plans get more sophisticated around this stuff, as we get better data that enables us better analysis of the membership so that we know better who's in greatest need of what, that's going to really inform, I think, much more meaningful benefit design around this stuff, starting first by a wider spread recognition that the first and best thing that we can do around social determinants is just to reduce or eliminate co-pays and deductibles, especially for the most vulnerable members who are low income. And that's been made worse by the raging unemployment and reduction in government benefits that we've seen during this administration. We all know, or we should know at this point, that co-payments and deductibles may be the way that we've always done it, but in the end, they really are just economic barriers to access, especially for the most vulnerable and folks with the greatest number of comorbidities. And we may not think that, you know, a $5 or $10 copay for a life-saving drug is a lot to us upper middle class healthcare executives, but for a dual eligible or for your more modest income beneficiaries who are living off a fixed income and reduced Social Security benefits, that $5 to $10 copay, you know, is the difference between food or medicine. And so the first thing that we can do to help start bend the curve on these costs is to eliminate or at least reduce those co-payments and deductibles for those critical services and drugs that these beneficiaries need. I think we're going to start to see tiered supplemental benefits among some of the market leaders. Certainly Anthem is going this way, and they have leapt way out in front of the pack in terms of leaders in Medicare Advantage in the last couple of years. I mean, I don't think anybody expected that out of Anthem, which was, you know, hardly an innovator in Medicare Advantage until Gail Boudreaux took over. Now you're going to start seeing from market leaders like Anthem, like Humana, tiered supplemental benefits around this, where, you know, beneficiaries in greater need will be able to select a silver or a gold or platinum level of supplemental benefits. Say if they need more home health care support, or they need more community health worker support, or they need a transportation benefit because there's just very little available in the markets that they live in. I think you'll see a wider availability of tiered benefits for folks to really tailor their own benefit designs for their personal needs. As we've said, vision, dental, hearing, and over-the-counter benefits are now the new table stakes. And I think in 2022 and going forward, we're probably going to see a lot more emphasis around medication therapy management and polypharmacy issues. I think you're going to start to see a lot more plans paying attention to opioid treatment, all of which, I mean, you know, while this pandemic has been raging, it's really silenced our attention around the opioid epidemic, which has gotten just devastatingly worse during this lockdown and unemployment. And we should not be naive in thinking that that has not happened among Medicare beneficiaries. It certainly happened among the Medicaid population, and certainly among the Obamacare plan populations as well. So looking at opioid treatment, which, you know, can really be done very well when it's done medication assisted, it can be done on an outpatient basis, it can even be done with telemedicine. And I think we're going to start to see more of that in years to come. I think with broader recognition of the critical relationship between mental and behavioral health conditions and their huge impact on underlying health conditions and comorbidities, I mean, I think we are all aware that depression is a 4x multiplier on other costs of chronic disease among our elders. And, you know, certainly that's the case with diabetes, with COPD, and with cardiac conditions, most notably. And so I think a lot more impact and investment in mental health parity and greater behavioral support. This has certainly been a huge priority for Aetna and Cigna, certainly among their elders. But guys, you know, especially among the Obamacare and Medicaid populations, especially, these two things go hand in hand. And the more attention that we pay to behavioral health conditions, the better we're going to do on bending the cost curve on medical costs down the road. I think there's huge recognition now around the massive costs that are associated with Alzheimer's and dementia. And I think, you know, a lot more attention there, first and foremost around better screening, and then the deployment of community health workers to help arrange and coordinate the massive level of medical and social services that Alzheimer's and dementia patients need to be able to get to some semblance of average healthcare expenditures for their age cohort. I think we're going to see greater emphasis around adult daycare. Not a lot of us are familiar with this. We're starting to see greater offering, especially again by Anthem, around a certain number of adult daycare visits per month that their beneficiaries can access. I mean, certainly for us, with the pandemic raging uncontrolled, especially in nursing homes and assisted living facilities, the whole notion of congregate care has gone up in smoke thanks to this virus. And so there's going to be a much greater emphasis on home and community-based settings, especially smaller congregate care settings, where seniors can address their needs for loneliness and social isolation, that you have a place where they are captive for, you know, 8 to 12 hours on any given day when they come in for adult daycare. Most importantly, this is the number one thing you can do around caregiver respite. And this is why we at Nightingale led a huge fundraising round for a company called Edenbridge Health, which is going to be one of the next biggies in the program of all-inclusive care, or PACE, for the elderly. I mean, these are adult daycare centers on steroids with now all kinds of new and creative wraparound services that they can send into home and community-based members with those they're caring for. And that is a model, guys, that I think all of us need to take a fresh look at and start thinking about adult daycare and more home and community-based solutions. We're going to see an explosion in 1915C home and community-based services waivers under the Biden administration with a whole new reconstituted innovation center. A lot of the emphasis is going to be around those HCBS services. So you guys need to get on that train, or you're going to be under it, because I think adult daycare's golden age is about to arrive. You're seeing similar initiatives on the Medicaid side of the ledger, guys. We now have at least 40 states that are addressing social determinants directly through their Medicaid programs, primarily through partnerships with community organizations and agencies for the low income and the elderly. You've got the vast majority of states that are now requiring plans to screen enrollees for social determinants and then to ensure and close the loop on referrals to services. You're going to see a lot more emphasis in quality measures from this administration, and especially from blue state Medicaid programs, around ensuring that these loops are closed and that beneficiaries in need of these types of social services are actually getting referred to those agencies, and that you're closing those loops and continually ensuring that those types of services are provided to them. You're going to see a lot more emphasis on supporting community-based organizations in their efforts to serve these underserved communities better. So you're going to see a lot more efforts around helping to grow, community food banks, community daycares, green groceries, and, a lot more efforts around food availability, around community transportation solutions, and other community-based organizations that frankly are out there doing a lot of this work already, but a lot of them are these little mom and pop shops, or they're, folks working out of church basements. They've worked off of grants or philanthropy or the goodness of their hearts up until now. And it's incumbent on all of us to help these community-based organizations scale up, to start acting more like businesses, to wean them off of grants and philanthropy, and to begin getting these types of vendors and community-based organizations on the path to value-based contracts. That is in our long-term interests, as now all of us will be social service network managers alongside provider service managers. And you're going to see a lot of emphasis around that in Medicaid, Obamacare, and Medicare Advantage regulation and guidance coming up in this administration. You're going to see, as we've been saying, across the board, a lot more investment in data collection and effectiveness measurement of these types of treatments. You've got a number of groundbreaking states that are requiring plans to identify the homeless and to link them to services, not just to housing, but just to better services. Look, I mean, you're going to have a lot of homeless folks out there that just don't want to be in housing. So you're going to start to see a lot more emphasis around these types of services, just doing what you can for them. It may not be the whole kit and caboodle of getting them into permanent supportive housing. That's very capital intense. It's very hard to get them to do it, and it's very long time to market with zoning and everything else, like not in my backyard politics. But there's still a lot that you can do for the homeless. And guys, this crisis around housing insecurity is going to explode. Remember, the eviction moratorium expires on January 1. we're going to see 8 to 12 million Americans evicted in first quarter and up to 40 million Americans evicted in 2021 if we do not pass legislation to the president and get it signed into law that extends that eviction moratorium. So we are going to see an explosion in homelessness and housing insecurity related costs among all of our beneficiaries across all business lines starting in second quarter of 21. And we really need to get a jump on this right now. So start paying attention to vendors like Samaritan out of Seattle, Washington, who do this amazing little device that they can just distribute to your homeless members and use it as almost like an ETF, where they can now use it for food benefits. They can use it to access just cash to pay for whatever it is that they need, like over-the-counter drugs and things of that sort, that they can use it for transportation to jobs or to a shelter, things of that sort. We're going to see interim measures around housing and those who are housing insecure for smart plans that jump ahead of this like we all need to. You're seeing a lot of states really starting to place some emphasis around food insecurity. You guys are all haunted, as I am, by watching the news of, you know, watching car lines stretching for 6 miles in Texas and, you know, Arizona of people waiting to get to food banks during this pandemic. Guys, we are 100% at risk for the cost of our members. And when they are starving and when cheap, terrible food is all that they are able to afford during this pandemic, when 47 million are unemployed and that number rising by almost a million a month, the best thing that we can be doing for folks is to address headlong food insecurity. And remember the enormous dividends that we get in reduced healthcare costs. Again, that's at least net $2,500 to $3,000 per member per year, just by making sure folks are food secure. You got a number of states that are now engaging in all kinds of healthy behavior incentive programs, like obesity mitigation, getting in for substance abuse treatment, and for smoking cessation. I think you're going to see a lot more incentives around chronic conditions like diabetes and better management of their A1Cs and things of that sort. If state Medicaid programs are doing it, guys, we should be way ahead of that in Obamacare and Medicare Advantage benefit design. So I want to leave you with the last few minutes in thinking about what it means now when we're 100% at risk for all of the healthcare costs of our members, guys. I mean, we are not just their healthcare providers. We are now their social service providers, if we're smart. And by addressing social services head on across our organizations and starting not just with benefit design, but mostly important in network management. You know, we invest billions of dollars as an industry in network management and provider relations. And we have to completely rethink what that means in a pandemic and in its aftermath, guys, because we are going to be dealing with this, even with a vaccine hitting the street. I mean, we're not going to see any sense of normalcy in our worlds until 2022 at the earliest. And the lingering effects of this are going to plague us for the next 5 years. And so thinking more expansively about what network management means is really sound advice for all of us, and that we really start thinking not just about what does that mean in terms of the vendors and types of providers that we need contracts with. The types of vendors and providers many of us have spent our careers running from, like scalded dogs, because that meant adverse selection, or it meant more poor sick people would join us. Well, we've got them now, and we're responsible for 100% of their healthcare costs. So that means our networks need to represent better, far better, the needs of our enrolled populations. So we need to start thinking about the kinds of services that providers to the underserved have done since the day they opened their doors. So look at what federally qualified health centers or rural health clinics provide, and you'll get a glimpse into this new normal in network management that we are going to need going forward forever, as my teenage daughters like to say. Meal providers, transportation vendors, you know, personal care attendants, community health workers, armies of community health workers, greater emphasis around rehabilitation and helping folks who've been injured or coming out of a long inpatient stay, get back on their feet and back in health. Assistive devices and greater emphasis around remote monitoring, especially when everybody's locked down. Far greater investment in home modifications and especially pest control and mold abatement for folks that have respiratory conditions. Better communication services. I mean, guys, we have members out there who are high risk, high cost, and they don't have a cell phone. I mean, it totally makes sense to make sure that they've got a smartphone so that you can keep tabs on them. And your care managers will thank you for just what that simple act does in making their work so much more effective. You'll see a lot more emphasis around, you know, in-home services and personal care. We've got to keep these members out of congregate care settings like nursing homes, where nobody wants to be, least of all our members, and we certainly don't want to pay for nursing home care. So that means the home and community-based settings as where we all need to shift investment and care management focus too, really makes a lot of sense. So really looking at what does this mean in terms of network management means we really need to look at what are the services the members need and dig into what's available and can we build on it. So here's a little sample of, you know, some of the network analysis that we do it at Nightingale before we make any investments through our fund in these social determinants interventions that we do. So for instance, in looking at my hometown of Detroit, which is certainly an underserved community and where, you know, the virus has been raging and we see all of the effects of social determinants over generations of the beneficiaries we serve there. When we dig into Detroit, just in Wayne County, we find there's only two food pantries there within a 20-mile radius of members with diabetes. That there is one local mini-mart that accepts EBT transfers. And that local mini-mart, half of the stuff on their shelves would kill or at least hospitalize somebody with congestive heart failure if they ate a can of condensed soup off their shelf, assuming that they had an EBT benefit card that they could use there. The state does support use of EBT and of food stamp or SNAP benefits at farmers markets, but there's only one available in all of Detroit, and there's no mobile farmers markets available anywhere. When we turn to housing and shelter, 63% of the homes in Detroit were built before 1980. So what does that tell you about the availability and the condition of that housing stock and the desperate need for home modifications and improvements so that beneficiaries can stay in their homes longer and more safely for the next several years? That the average annual repairs through a local network of home modification vendors looks to be about $1,200 per household. That's not a little amount of money, but in those members who need it the most, and if not making those repairs renders that home unlivable, and now they end up housing insecure or worse, homeless, that $1,200 would pay off in multiples years down the road. But there's only two programs in Detroit that do any sort of home modification support, and there's only 10 local contractors in the entire city that engage in that program. So looking for vendors that do this stuff now, looking at food pantries and community kitchens, and whether or not Meals on Wheels can meet the demand, or if you have to look to other vendors, or you may have to build your own commercial kitchen to start doing meal delivery at scale for those who need it. When we look at transportation, again, in Detroit, there's only one volunteer transport program there. There's three active vendors, but their scale is very limited. They're basically a bunch of church van groups. There's very limited availability of medical transport, especially for the disabled, and those benefits are generally limited to medically needed transport only, not to get somebody to a well checkup at a doctor's office, to get them to a pharmacy to pick up the drugs that they need so badly. A lot of forward-looking plans are starting to look at paying for rides to grocery stores so that they're not eating that crap off the bodega shelf and they're able to get to a produce department. And a lot of those transportation vendors require a minimum 2-day advance schedule, which, for a lot of beneficiary needs just doesn't work. Those needs are a lot more urgent and time sensitive than a 2-day scheduling would allow. So this is the level of analysis that we all need to begin to invest in. We need to invest in screening all of our members for social determinants, certainly doing during the annual well checkup in Medicare, and certainly any time that you get them into a provider's office, to give those providers a little spiff if they ask a few basic questions about social determinants of health while they've got them there. I mean, any amount of data, just 5 or 6 questions that they can ask those members, are you having trouble getting food on the table? Are you in danger of being evicted? Or do you have access to transportation for services or to appointments like this one? That are critically important little data points for benefit design and for provider and network vendor needs assessments so that we're going forward. So with that, Mike, let me turn it over to you, and I'm sure we've got a few questions for folks, and let's get to those.
All right, we do have a few questions. Before I get started with these, I would like to remind everyone that you are able to enter your questions into the questions pane, and we will read them for John and Mike to address. So the first question that we've got comes from Julie Portola at the California Medical Association. And Julie asks, on the topic of surprise medical bills, is it just COVID-related surprise medical bills that are a priority, or are all surprise medical bills?
It's a great question, Julie. Thank you. No, I think we should expect that they're going to be all surprise medical bills, but especially COVID-related bills. We're already starting to see these horror stories of folks getting hit with thousands of dollars in fees for COVID testing or for treatment. Certainly COVID's going to be a priority, and I think we'll probably be at the heart of a lot of the arguments for surprise billing legislation and regulation. But no, I don't think they're going to stop there, Julie. I think, all surprise bills, especially coming out of inpatient locations, hospitals, and rehab facilities especially, are really going to be under the microscope there.
Okay, very good. Next question, also from Julie at California Medical Association. Can you elaborate on CMMI as it relates to SDOH?
Sure. We've seen some limited demonstrations out of this administration's innovation center around social determinants of health and specifically addressing poverty. You've got a couple of those waivers that have been issued to state Medicaid departments and to some states more broadly in their exchange. Around using certain waiver authorities to offer anti-poverty benefits like better home and community-based services. You're seeing some programs around addressing homelessness and a few others, as I mentioned, in the Medicaid portion of the discussion. But I think this innovation center under Biden is really going to be firmly planted around innovation, as I said, in health equity and in social determinants and in value-based care offerings more generally. I think you're going to see several demos that will get announced around directly addressing health disparities and providing some sort of bonus payment for providers and for plans that very rapidly and successfully start to address health disparities, which, you know, range broadly from, you know, everything from administering pain medications to African Americans, which is woefully behind, to, as we said earlier, prenatal care, postpartum care for women of color. Things of that sort, I think, are probably going to be a key focus of this innovation center. And it won't just be limited to Medicaid or state programs. I think you'll see a lot of that really focusing on the Medicare population. I think you're going to start to see probably a lot more emphasis around this stuff in the Medicare ACO program and probably in the direct contracting administration. Again, health equity and disparities address are going to be just blanket causes for the Biden administration, which is, you know, why I say this is going to be, I think, a golden age of health equity. And we also be prepared for a whole lot more accountability around disparity reduction as a result.
All right, thank you. Next question from Susan Erickson with the Matrix Medical Network. Who do you expect to see nominated for HHS Secretary and CMS Administrator?
We got pools going on this office here, here in our office. I honestly have no idea who Joe's looking at for CMS. There are so many wonderfully qualified people for the position. All I know is it's not going to be some sycophant, poor person basher like Seema Verma. HHS Secretary is a lot more interesting, and I think a much more narrow list of candidates. I think it's almost certain that appointee will be a person of color. I think likely to be a woman, but I've heard a dozen names, but a lot of them, interestingly, revolve around Dr. Vivek Murthy, who was Obama's Surgeon General, and, you know, just a wonderful guy who really understands the huge reach of HHS. I mean, it is the biggest agency well beyond the Pentagon. And so I think that's going to be a very carefully thought out couple of appointments, but man, I have no idea who could end up at CMS. HHS certainly expect a person of color, and I would say 60-40 a woman in that position. And I think we'd all welcome that.
All right, this next question is from Robin Dow Morales of Kern Health Systems. Without copays / deductibles, when the member has no skin in the game, how do we stop usage of ERS as PCP offices or simply increase in missed appointments, thus causing an access issue?
Well, I think the whole notion of copays and deductibles as skin in the game needs to go the way of the dinosaur, man. I mean, this isn't skin. I mean, as I tried to say, a $5 or $10 or $20, $25 copay, you know, it breaks the bank for the folks who need these services the most. I certainly understand having one for unnecessary ER visits. I think you can look at being punitive, which is really what a copayment or a deductible is to poor folks, by flipping it on its head and giving folks a bonus or a credit for showing up at a PCP office or going to an urgent care instead of the ER for something that's non-urgent. that we provide them readily available transportation to doctor's appointments, which is one of the biggest reasons why they miss them and why docs patient census is so far down now during this pandemic. It's not, you know, because people don't want to be there. I mean, certainly among our seniors, docs, you know, they need to see their doctors a lot, and they're not going, not because they can afford a copayment or a deductible, and also because most of them, many of them, can't get there. So providing them a ride free of cost, making it pretty easily and readily available, and offering that to them when you know they've got an appointment coming up. I mean, I get, my phone blows up when I got a doctor's appointment coming up with texts. Are you coming? Are you coming? And that text also says, do you need a ride? Reply, why? And we'll arrange for a ride for you to get to your doctor's appointment. This is the kind of critical rethinking we've got to do around any notion of copays and deductibles as skin in the game or the way we've always done it. They are economic barriers to access that disproportionately screw the poor. And those are the folks that we need to improve access to these services for.
All right. And this next question is from our good friend Bill Barcelona with America's Physician Groups. And he says, John, what delegated model risk shifting issues do you see arising with all of these benefit changes that you were discussing?
It's a great question, as we always expect from Bill. I mean, listen, I know in the California delegated model, and everybody's downstream at 80%, that basically everything I say to health plans when I speak to you guys is also the same words that the providers that are taking that risk need to understand it as well. It's an interesting conundrum when you're talking about off benefit services like we've been talking about. It certainly inures to the provider's benefit more than it does to the plan's benefit that all these types of services and benefits we've been talking about are made available to these members when 80% of the benefit and the cost savings are going to accrue to the provider. And so I think the plans have to look at, hey, look, you know, you guys are still on the hook for 20% of that risk. So it doesn't mean it's all on the downstream providers to do this. You guys still will see 20% of the benefit from bending the curve on these vulnerable populations. But more to the point, what the plans need to understand is that the providers are going to need 80% of the support to get this done. And that's why we've got to really rethink network management. We got to rethink provider relationships to include investment and program design, intervention design, and how that all ties in to the care management we're doing at the plan level, and the providers are doing care management at their level when they've got 80% of the burden. We need to think about how do we shift more of that focus, investment, and you know, all of that heat to the providers so that they can do this well for all of us. So I totally get it that delegated model is, you know, a complete game changer in ways that we think about this, but I think it really encourages a far more expansive and innovative view from the plan side about what this has to mean around provider relations and network management, and that we need to invest heavily in the providers doing it. Does that make sense? Mike, certainly as a delegated provider that most of your career.
No, John, I was going to add, I think all of what you're saying in that regard is certainly true. I think one of the key aspects of ensuring success, and this has been a gap for a long time in the delegated model, is really that collaboration and communication. We've got to coordinate these benefits effectively wherever it lands relative to, you know, kind of directing care and initiating access. It's fine, and certainly we have to finance that. But I think it's going to be important for us as an industry to do better, a better job than we've done in the past around collaborating and communicating so that our beneficiaries are getting the full effect of the opportunity.
Mike, if you think collaborating and communicating is hard, where do you try investing?
Yeah.
I mean, when there's real money on the line and plans are now having to think about multi-million dollar investments for it to be meaningful into services that are primarily going to benefit their provider partners, that's when shit gets real. If you're having trouble communicating or collaborating now, wait till you see what happens when there's real money on the table and the true nature of those relationships and that communication reveals itself. So work on it now and really start to think about what are the structures that we want to embody in making real investments and coordination at the care management level in what we're doing for these patients for our collective good. But man, when it gets down to financing, that's when the real rubber hits the road and best to repair and get those provider communications and collaboration pathways down now before there's real money on the table.
Absolutely.
Okay. This one is from Danita Wolf of United Healthcare. And the question is, in rural and frontier areas, the technology required to process EBT WIC benefits is often cost prohibitive for the small local stores, resulting in WIC eligible members not receiving benefits. Have you heard any conversations about states assisting small, rural, and frontier areas with paying for the technology to accept EBT WIC cards?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, exacerbated by this pandemic and the fact that right now it's raging across, you know, the heartland of the country where so many rural populations live. It is expensive. We are starting to see some of the more forward-looking states get that way. I'd watch Arizona for this. They usually tend to be pretty good at this stuff. But I think rather than providing thousands of stores with the technology to process EBT, I think you're probably gonna see a lot more distribution of EBT benefits on Visa cards or on, you know, basic credit cards that that can be, you know, taken at these, you know, these small retail stores that these beneficiaries are shopping in far more easily than say a token or some of the other EBT technologies that we've seen out there. Just the ability to process a credit card should be able to do it. And I think you'll probably see a lot more efficacy there as a result. Now, you know, anytime you're talking rural or frontier though, the first social determinant investment we should be thinking about though is broadband internet access, guys. And getting broadband out to that last mile. So one, we have some hope of basic monitoring and basic communications with the members that, you know, that they can do telehealth appointments and things of that sort. That really is should be the base layer of any effort there. And it's frankly some of the stuff that's most complex and most expensive to make happen. So thinking about broadband in the context of anything you're doing in social determinants and those types of communities, really, really important.
So the next one is from Carvel Teft of Pacific Partners, who says, John, I didn't hear much of an emphasis on obesity mitigation, yet the cost of obesity is estimated to be equivalent to 9% of GDP. Can you comment?
I mean, not for lack of attention or priority, certainly. I mean, anytime we say the word diabetes, we need to be thinking about obesity mitigation, obviously. I tend to think obesity is woefully underreported in this country. It has certainly gotten worse during the lockdown and the pandemic. And, you know, certainly this last year, the Trump administration, certainly the amount of stress eating I was doing, if that's reflective on the rest of America, I think it's critical. Now, obesity mitigation is also one of the hardest things to intervene with. And so we really have to be thinking anytime We're trying to focus on diabetes that we, of course, have to hand in glove look at obesity mitigation. So anytime we're trying to improve people's hemoglobin A1Cs, that means we got to get them eating right. We've got to get sugar under control. We got to get them exercising because that drops blood sugar and cholesterol. We've got to get these folks more active. These are, but these are lifestyle interventions that are very difficult to get folks to stick with. But I think it really has to begin with better diet and better availability of healthy food. I mean, obesity is, you know, one of the central social determinants of health because we subsidize terrible food in this country by making it so cheap. And so the what you get is this almost permanent underclass in this country that's going to be forever obese unless we make healthier food more affordable. I mean, certainly when we do that, there's research all over the place that shows that lower income people flock to healthier food options when given them. So while these types of lifestyle interventions are very difficult, like getting somebody who's at, you know, morbidly obese to go walk 2 miles a day, that's very hard to do. But they're far more willing to embrace healthy food. Again, just like doctor's appointments, we make it cheaper and more available for them. They will do it. So I, you know, I'd always say anytime you're thinking about that, food availability and affordability is going to be the number one thing that we can do for populations with this condition.
All right. Thank you for that. We've got another question from Susan Erickson of Matrix Medical Network. And the question is, what are your predictions on telehealth risk adjusting for MA longer than the pandemic?
Well, certainly telehealth is here to stay. I think it's going to be wildly popular among seniors who are getting online for this type of stuff in rapidly growing numbers. And that's very encouraging. It's certainly going to be here to stay among the Obamacare population, less so among the Medicaid populations, only because you have fewer numbers of them with access to smartphones as opposed to, you know, just flip phones or cellular phones that are capable of a lot of telehealth stuff. But telehealth as risk adjustment is an interesting development, and I think it will be allowed to contribute to that one best record, especially where you're doing telehealth primary care or the annual wellness visit online. I don't think it'll have near the impact that house calls have had on improving the collection of RAF score data and diagnostic data, but it certainly could have some impact, and it may even reveal some things that we haven't done through house calls or other, because it will actually give us a look into people's homes. I mean, if we're paying attention, there's a lot that you can glean from a telehealth visit in a patient's home just by looking around. There's a lot that you can glean from having somebody who's dropping off food due by just a layperson's observation when they're in the home. But, you know, it's certainly going to be something that CMS is going to be considering a priority. I don't know that we're going to see complete parity in payment around telehealth visits as opposed to in-person visits, but I think we could get kind of close.
So this will be our final question. I want to thank everyone for their questions and for supporting this conversation. This has been great. This question comes from Tom Bornheimer from Kaiser Permanente. And he says, I understand the need for mold abatement and other building issues. I do not understand pest control as a large benefit, as I have never had pest control ever.
Well, it's kind of like the cops, man. You really only want it when you really need it, you know. Pest control when you live in substandard housing, pest control is something that weighs on you every hour of every day. When you live in a place that's got infestation, or it's got cockroaches, or it's got mold, which is, you know, in a lot of inner city communities with really rapidly declining housing stock that goes back to the pre-war era, home modifications and pest control is the number one thing that you can do to improve living conditions for these very low income members that we all serve. And until you've been there, you really can't appreciate how critically important it is. When we were working on Medicare Advantage benefit design, when I was at Gorman Health Group before I retired, one of the things that we really encouraged plans to do during benefit design was to go do a ride along with your sales agents, especially for those that were going out to do appointments with dual eligibles. And one of the first things that you learn from sales agents that work in the dual eligible community is that you never wear pants with cuffs on a visit to a dual, because invariably you're going to come out of there with cockroaches or bed bugs in the pants, the cuffs of your pants. And that's the kind of stuff that most of us upper middle class healthcare executives never would even think of until you've seen it. And when you see it, it'll change your perspective on the way that you do benefit design, the way that you do network management, the way that you think about care management for these very sick, vulnerable, low-income people. It'll change the way you think about everything. But pest control is absolutely necessary, and is one of the most impactful in terms of member affinity and retention that you can do for your members. And most of us never even think of it, but I encourage you to do so. Hope that helps. Anthony, Mike, Patty, everybody at ICE, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for, and congratulations on your 22nd anniversary. I'm happy to say that I was here at the birth, Mike.
Thank you, John. We appreciate it. And we thank everyone for attending this session today. It's been very informational, very helpful. And John, always on point. Thanks so much. And thanks
Happy
again, everyone.
Friends. Okay. Happy Take on. Care, everybody.
Bye-bye.